Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Luke's Fascination with 40, The Resurrected Jesus, Appearing to Them During 40 Days. It is presented by Fred Strickert. The number is STF2002-08. Let's listen in.
Today's topic is to look at Luke and resurrection. And we've been doing the whole series, and I mentioned before, on trying to make a connection with Holden Village and 40 years of wilderness. And so some days it's more wilderness and some days it's the 40. And here, our point to try to make the connection is, I mean, we have the 40 days listed here. And I've never read the resurrection stories and tried to make a connection with wilderness before. But we may try to see, you know, is there anything there we can maybe come from a different perspective and look at that. But basically, it's not in Luke. Of course, in Luke, and we'll look at this, in Luke chapter 24, you have the empty tomb, the women at the tomb, and we'll have the story of the Emmaus disciples, and I want to go back and look at that in detail. And then Jesus appears to the disciples that evening, and then it ends with a reference to Jesus withdrawing from their presence. And then Luke picks up in the book of Acts, same author here, starts off after this brief introduction, basically after his suffering, Jesus presented himself alive to them by many convincing proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. While staying with them, he ordered them not to leave Jerusalem, but to wait there for the promise. And then goes on talking about how that came out of the baptism of John with water, and now the Holy Spirit with fire. And eventually then, well, the disciples immediately start picking up on this concept of kingdom, what really do we mean by kingdom. And they are to wait, and they are commissioned to be witnesses when the Holy Spirit comes upon them, first in Jerusalem, then Judea and Samaria, and then to the ends of the earth. And then, in their presence, he's lifted up into heaven. And they go back to Jerusalem and wait for the Spirit of Pentecost. So anyway, we have the 40 days. Luke is the only one who refers to the 40 days of resurrection appearances. And this, at the very beginning, just to kind of reflect a little bit on this, I mean, how exactly we think about this. In Luke's gospel, some people have thought about this as a, you know, how do we understand those 40 days? Is that just a long period of time? That's frequently the way the 40 days in the ancient world was. That's a long period of time. So there were appearances over a long period of time. And if we take the gospel of Luke and Acts side by side, a lot of scholars have wondered exactly how the 40 days comes in. Because if you start, this is an abbreviated, so I want to get everything on one page, so I just kind of highlighted a few things with scissors and paste here. But we start off with the empty tomb and the women, and then Peter runs to the tomb. And notice it's now that same day, so that Sunday afternoon, we're going to have the Emmaus disciples. And they then refer to this vision that the women had that morning. So they're aware of that. So all this is taking place that afternoon, and it becomes evening time when they get there, and they invite Jesus to be with them, and then the breaking of bread. And as soon as they recognize Jesus, as soon as he breaks the bread, their eyes are open. But then Jesus is no longer with them. And they immediately jump up and return all the way back to Jerusalem. And they find the 11 gathered together. And they're excited because they're going to announce that Jesus has appeared to them. And the 11 are excited. And, well, Jesus has already appeared to Simon Peter. And they share their stories. And sure enough, Jesus is there in their midst. So all this is Sunday. All this is Sunday, not 40 days. The end of Luke is an emphasis on what happened that Sunday. And then, verse 50, and I don't know what different translations, what kind of linkage they have there, but then he led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. And while he was blessing them, he withdrew from them and was carried up into heaven. So this is a reference to the ascension already here. And you know, the big question here is then, all this is Sunday, and some commentators would read this as this is actually something that occurred that Sunday evening after that meal. So the ascension would already be taking place at that time. If we only had the Gospel of Luke and Maria, does anybody else have anything else besides then here? As far as the connected?
This one says when instead of then.
When you led them out?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that could be.
And then.
A little further. You have then? Yeah. But when?
Then.
Because it could refer to something quite late, much later on or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you're reading just then, are you thinking a gap of as long as 40 days or anything like that? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't naturally do that. And a number of commentators have been puzzled by that and said, well, Luke wrote all this. He had the resurrection stories. And there might have been a gap between the time he writes Luke and then he starts Acts. And then he had a different insight and described this as taking place over a longer time. And so here, it's Jesus presented himself alive during 40 days, so oftentimes, but over a longer period of time. And then we get the ascension. And does Luke have a different understanding between the time that he wrote Luke and Acts? And when you're talking about different understandings, when you start looking at the different gospel texts, this is a chart that I just picked up out of, and I'm not sure even which book it was, but Raymond Brown was a Roman Catholic scholar, well respected, maybe from his commentary on John, but sees, trying to sketch out how you understand appearing over 40 days. The Luke picture, and this is, kind of what I grew up on, is the idea Jesus rose from the dead and he was hanging around on earth, walking around just like normal, continuously for 40 days. And then, after 40 days, you have the ascension. And now, so that's where you have these appearances, but they're all part of this continuous kind of thing. But then, after the ascension, you have, in a sense, an appearance. Pentecost, sending of the Spirit, is a revelation of who Jesus is. When Stephen, the deacon, has been stoned there in Jerusalem, just before his death, he has a vision and he sees Jesus standing on the throne of God. And in a sense, that would be another appearance. And then Paul, his conversion, seeing Jesus in the heavens as a different kind of appearance. So there are heavenly appearances in a way that are rather vague and distant, but the 40 days are rather intimate, very close. Jesus is down here on earth. Now that's the Luke Acts picture. But now what's interesting when you look at John, Brown sketched this out as really John's understanding is almost the ascension happens right away. Jesus is raised that Sunday morning. He's no longer there, and he immediately is ascended to heaven, and then he makes these sporadic appearances, not a continuous presence, but sporadic appearances. First to Mary Magdalene, on Easter, Yeah, these are all on Easter Day. First to Mary Magdalene, and then that Sunday night appearing to the disciples. And then Jesus is no longer there or no longer visible or whatever for that next week, a week later, then he appears to the 11 when Thomas is there. And then sometime later, how much later we don't know, but he appears in Galilee and they go fishing in that particular episode. So that's a different model from what you end up having here in Luke Acts. Instead of this continuous kind of thing. And then if you take Paul, you know, Paul in 1 Corinthians, which would be the earliest, Paul's understanding is rather intriguing because in 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about what is of greatest importance. This is the nutshell of the gospel for him. And then he starts that Jesus, you know, was crucified, that he was buried, that he rose, and then appeared. And then he lists a half dozen appearances. And again, it seems like it's closer to the John model where Jesus, you know, is raised and, you know, raised into heaven. And then they're listed first to Cephas, which would be Simon Peter, then the 12, then an appearance to over 500, which we have no real description except here, then to James, then to all the apostles. And then what's interesting about this is that, and also to Paul. You know, he says, and finally to me, and Paul understands it as the last of the appearances was to him. And, I mean, what's, of course, with this, it's 3-4 years later. I mean, everybody is, I think, in pretty much agreement that what happens to Paul on the Damascus Road was 3 or 4 years later, not, you know, not 40 days, but it's a, you know, it's a long time later. And it's interesting, too, that Paul sees what happens to him in as similar to these others. Now, the 12, you know, appearance of the 12 and making the connection here on Sunday night, being with the disciples, is in a room here on earth in Jesus' presence. And you get the, you know, the eating together. We're going to talk about that. That's quite different than the picture we have of Paul seeing the vision, kind of the heavenly vision. But Paul makes the connection that he sees what happened to him is no different from these others here.
What was that from the river?
He said that came
from... I'm not sure if that's from... Yeah, he has this fabulous commentary on John from the Anchor Bible series. It was back in the 70s. And he also has a book, a small little book, that is basically two themes that he deals with. And one is the virgin birth, and the other is in the bodily resurrection. That was Paulus Press. And it might have been from that section. I actually don't recall it. But anyway, as far as understanding those 40 days, how you understand it, whether it's been a continuous thing on earth or a series of unconnected appearances. As far as Luke's understanding, there is a passage in Acts 10, if you have Bibles there, Acts chapter 10, 41, is a reference back. And anybody else, any Bibles, I can grab a bunch here. Are you okay for those who don't? We're not going to, a lot of stuff I'll have them just look on the screen today. That's going to be, this is one passage I just had you look up. This takes place, this is Simon Peter's experience with the Roman centurion Cornelius, and Jesus, that Simon has been sent to his house. And of course, Cornelius is a Gentile, and Peter's eyes are opened up that the mission is going to include the Gentiles. And it strikes him when he's there that the Spirit is upon Cornelius and his family. And Peter has a nice little sermon there. In a nutshell, what did the early disciples do as far as what was their preaching? And I think it actually starts up in 34 or something like that. We start talking about and how Jesus was anointed and went around doing good and then his arrest. But I think, is it 41 where he talks about the resurrection? Mm-hmm. But does anybody want to just read that for me? It has a translation over here? Do I have to be shy? Okay, please.
Starts on 40. Excuse me. It says, but God raised him from death 3 days later and caused him to appear. Not to everyone, but only to the the witnesses that God had already chosen, that is, to us waiting for him after he rose from death.
Okay, now notice, yeah. The focus is that he appeared, and it sounds like, and it frequently, it doesn't use the word frequently, but he caused him to appear. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is, you know, not to everybody.
Yeah, just by those chosen.
But to those who are chosen, which, you know, if you think of this idea of Jesus as, you know, continuing as before, it's, you know, everybody can experience him. But it's specific individuals that receive this kind of thing. So that seems to fit more into this kind of model. I don't know if... So that's Simon Peter. But the other part about it is kind of interesting, is that Simon Peter uses the reference to eating and drinking with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and in a way, that kind of sounds like this, you know, sharing regular meals together. So on one hand, that suggests one model, and on the other, it suggests the other. Now, I want to go back to Acts 1, because the second verse here is kind of interesting. He presented himself alive to them by many convincing proofs. And that's kind of interesting, because the word there, the convincing proofs, the word that's used there, that's the only time that shows up in the New Testament. But certain things, you know, not just appearing and them wondering, but there's something about that appearance that convinces them and, you know, it really changes them, especially, you know, Simon Peter from one who denies to somebody who's bold to stand up, or a Paul who's an opponent, or James who's really doubting, or Thomas who's doubting. And so you have these convincing proofs. But what intrigues me here is the next verse is, while staying with them, he ordered them not to leave Jerusalem, but to wait there for the promise of the Father. And now this, while staying with them, he ordered them not to leave. And we have a footnote here. A, down here, says, or eating. That was what we ran across in that Acts 10 thing, eating and drinking together. While eating with them, or while staying with them. And the Greek word there, again, is a word that only shows up one time in the Bible. But I was curious, what are different translations have for that? I don't know what variety we have here today, but this, I think this is, I'm pretty sure this is New RSV. They have chosen to interpret this as while staying with him. And that sounds like more of a continuous kind of thing. But
so obviously it's not menos, it's something else.
It's not?
Menos, remaining with
him. Oh, yeah, no, it's not the verb to remain, like abide with me, like it's in the Emmaus disciple. No, that's not the word. And I can actually, if you want to see what the Greek word looks like, any of you, I sometimes feel reluctant to put it up here, but this, it's synalizo. Okay, but this is first, before we actually talk about what translations do you have?
Yes, NIV says eating with them.
Yeah, the NIV has chosen to, and eating together as far as the interpretation.
Mine says, and when they came together, but then the footnote goes down to say while he was staying with them or eating with them.
Okay, so came together, staying,
came together,
eating. But that's footnote. So yes, they have chosen that this, the came together.
But they came together, yeah.
But the footnote, yeah, instead of
staying or
rather
eating.
Rather than eating. You know what translation it is?
It's today's English version.
Okay, yeah. Okay, today's English version or the Good News Bible.
The message says, and as they met and ate meals together.
So they do both.
Mm-hmm.
We'll include both of those. That's
yes,
a safe one, okay?
Yes.
That's the way you do it. You're starting out with one of both, right? Okay? I checked, the King James opted for the staying with them as well, or something, or when they were gathered together, or something like that. And not too many have opted for the eating one. But, again, now the word, literally, basically, you could take it. There is a word that's similar that means to be gathered together. But it would have to be plural if it's referring to and the disciples were gathered together. It's a singular. So it's what Jesus is doing. And it's a a passive kind of thing. It's not Jesus gathering them together the way it's worded there. So linguistically, grammatically, that doesn't work the best, to say to be gathered together. What works the best is, and Jesus is the subject, and Jesus is eating with them. Jesus is the subject of the verb. But the root, it's synalizo. And there's two things in this. The sin part means something you do together. But the part that's translated as the eating together comes from the word for salt. They were sharing salt together, which is kind of an odd kind of thing. Now, the one in Acts chapter 10 uses the regular word for eating and sharing food. But why would you have an expression that's referring to salt? Does anybody know anything about salting together, being salted together?
Salt is very valuable.
Okay, there's something valuable about it, okay? What else do we know about the salt?
Salt also used in contracts and covenants and things.
And
it brings out.
Okay, do you know of any examples? Okay, we'll get back. Do you know of any examples of that?
I'm just jogging my memory. I read a whole book on salt.
You read a whole book? Oh, wow. Okay.
There's a book out called Salt.
It's just called Salt.
And it tells the whole history.
And frequently, so it's a kind of covenant kind of thing, is you share salt. Which and that really worked kind of nice because, I mean, basically Jesus appearing to them, there has to be a restoration. You know, their agreement together has been split by them deserting Jesus, and now this is a way of making that covenant new. So that I like that. Okay, and there's one over here suggesting as far as salt brings out things, brings out flavors.
When he refers to salt, the salt of the earth.
Yeah. You are the salt of the earth, and it's... So is that a way of him being with them and now lifting up their qualities, which have kind of slipped away. Okay? Mm-hmm.
But it's also a preservative.
And it's a preservative.
So it would bring a
continual kind of thing. So, eating together is a one-time kind of thing, but it's... Somehow this is an eating together that is going to have a lasting kind of effect here.
Well, he's reminding them, convincing them of the proof of who he is. And you're saying the convincing proof.
Mm-hmm. The salt is, it preserves that. Any other kind of cultural things about the salt? I like that,
On a farm, cattle have to have salt. It's a basic salt.
It's a basic kind of,
Your body has to.
Bread is a basic, salt is a basic. Anybody else as far as where you use salt?
In baking, if you're baking with yeast, you have to have some salt to control how long the yeast works. You need sugar to grow the yeast, but you need salt to stop the action. So it's the right proportion.
Okay. Has anybody here ever traveled to Soviet Union or now Russia? As far as a group, anything special about salt there? I'm fishing because I know of an experience. I've heard a couple of times by people traveling there in groups. I was first introduced to this by a colleague of mine who went on a trip at least maybe about 12 years ago. And then our daughter has done a lot of work in Russia and kind of reinforced this for us. But when my colleague visited there, they were with a large delegation and they came to this community. Well, actually, I think almost every community, when they were welcomed, the welcoming party would always bring out bread and salt. Have you ever heard that? The day, if you have that when you're there, were you there as individuals or as groups or being, as kind of delegation?
We went there as a delegation.
But nobody ever came out. That kind of struck me. They brought out bread and salt.
Bread and jelly or bread and salt.
But in a way, is that a sign, of hospitality? But it's a lasting hospitality. Bread, today, come share my bread. But the salt is almost kind of, but our hospitality is going to be lasting, the preserving kind of thing.
Is the salt just symbolic? Do you eat the salt as a sign of gratitude, or what do you do with it?
I don't know if they're supposed to eat it there. I don't think they necessarily.
Just sitting on the table as an adornment, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's symbolic. Yeah, so it's symbolic of our hospitality is going to continue on. Yeah, so you don't sit there and just eat a little bit of salt. It's a symbolic thing. So I don't know. You know, I mean, and that kind of fits in. You know, I haven't heard about this in biblical culture kind of stuff. But I mean, what's interesting is, I mean, it appeals to me that instead of using the while staying. I like the while eating together, and because eating is not just eating. Eating is building relationships, and that's what the key. You know, Jesus is rebuilding, I guess, the relationships that have been broken with the disciples, and setting the pattern for what's going to be happening now in the early church. And Luke has this. I printed out a whole bunch of passages here that this is a theme of the early church. Not, they never mentioned the salt thing again, but the eating, the breaking the bread. I mean, here we have the one that I had you look at before, where Simon Peter is referring back to these appearances while Jesus is alive, and Jesus ate and drank, the disciples ate and drank with him after he rose. So there it's the sharing, eating and drinking. But we're going to go back and look at the Emmaus disciples story. And, of course, the key to that story is when they finally sit down at the table and Jesus takes the bread. And, I mean, the way it's told, I mean, he takes the bread. And the interesting thing is, in this case, they're the ones who are sharing the bread with him. But he takes the bread and he blesses it and he breaks it and then he shares it with them. And it never describes them eating that bread, but in the breaking of the bread, then their eyes are opened. So that's a key text here. Then when he goes back, then when they go back to Jerusalem with all the disciples, the Emmaus disciples are reporting to the Jerusalem disciples, this is what we saw, and vice versa. Then all of a sudden, Jesus said, well, here I am, look at me. And in this case, they share a piece of broiled fish. In this case, he eats it. And that's kind of a convincing kind of proof that, you know, a spirit doesn't eat fish. So you have bread, you have fish, and the eating and the drinking. And as far as the resurrection appearances, I think of the other Gospels, does it ever come up of eating and drinking the other Gospels?
Well, isn't it John 21 that doesn't he eat the fish?
The fish on the seashore after they've caught the fish. They have a morning little service there, the fish to bear. He's actually cooking to begin with, and then they bring more fish, So I think that's the only other one that really emphasizes the eating together. Mm-hmm. But then how that continues is with Acts chapter 2, of course, is Pentecost. And the Pentecost is the sending of the Spirit, but in a sense, that's also an appearance of Jesus. That's after the ascension, but it's, you know, again, it's a convincing proof in a spiritual kind of way. And as a reaction to Pentecost, number one, there's immediate growth that takes place in the community. And then at the end of the Pentecost story, which is Acts chapter 2, there are two references. One, all these people in the church devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayers. So those become the four marks of the Christian community. Teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayers. And then the next one, just a couple verses later, day by day, they spend a lot of time in the temple yet. But at home, they break bread, ate food together with glad and generous hearts. And what I see here is is really a development coming out of the time Jesus had spent with them that we looked at in Acts. And the other day we were talking about how the women traveled with Jesus and they shared from their possessions. And that then becomes the hallmark of the early Christians, that they are what Jesus has taught them there. Now, by him coming and breaking bread with them, they're saying, this is what our life is together. we are sharing our possessions, and you know, and people actually selling their fields and that kind of thing. So it's a sharing community, and the eating together is symbolic of that. We share what we have. And I mean, that's in the early days. And then it continues on. These last two references are to Paul, where breaking of the bread then becomes another name for the Eucharist. That's probably one of the most popular names. And it's when Paul is traveling to Troas, this is many years later, there's a gathering, and the gathering is on the first, and the emphasis is on the first day of the week. And on the first day of the week, when we met to break bread, Paul then had a discussion. So the people were breaking bread on the first day of the week. And you know, this is going back to that Sunday evening when they broke bread, when they ate together. And that's, you know, deliberately choosing to follow that particular time instead of the Sabbath worship, the Sunday night kind of thing. And then one that's really kind of striking, because, and this is the followers all gathering together, but when Paul is on his trip from Caesarea as a prisoner, he's on a prison ship. And as far as we know, you know, it's primarily non-Christians who are on that ship, and then they run into troubles at sea, and everybody is kind of panicking, you know, what's going to happen to us? Paul takes bread in the presence of all, gives thanks, and broke it, and began to eat. But it's something that assures everybody in the ship, even all, you know, Roman soldiers and all these other prisoners, that Jesus is there in their midst. So you get that. And so the eating and drinking, and the share, the eating and drinking assures them of Christ's presence, and it's also turning them toward the other as far as the sharing kind of thing. But it all comes, you know, in that 40 days being together. Please.
Doesn't that also help to prove that it was a physical resurrection, or it wasn't a spirit or a ghost, that if he's actually eating with them?
Yeah, and that's...
not a vision to them, it's actually...
Yeah, I mean, that's... I guess in the initial state, that's why you have that word by convincing proofs. And I think that's why it's important. I mean, in my way of reading it, I like interpreting that one word, synaluzzo, as eating in the very next verse. And those two kind of things go together. But it's not just, you know, this is a proof kind of thing. It's the other things too, I think. Yeah. Okay.
So what assumptions do you make about when this was written and who wrote it?
I've always assumed this is written fairly late, and this is like in the 80s or 90s. So we're talking 50 years at least after the resurrection, sorry, as when it occurred. I still assume that this is written by a Gentile, somebody who was not an eyewitness. I assume Luke and Acts are together, and it's not an eyewitness, which is quite clear from the very introduction, where he separates himself from the eyewitnesses. And somebody who is maybe a second-generation Christian or even a third-generation Christian. So somebody who has, you know, has gotten material from other people. I still, and as far as Luke, I have no problem still seeing Luke as being somebody who is a follower of Paul. In a lot of circles, you know, it's questionable. You know, say, well, it doesn't always present Paul accurately, but somebody, I mean, it's a lot later. And I have no problem with, you know, Paul had a companion named Luke, and I'm satisfied with that. And Luke is a Gentile. You know, as far as what I want to do the rest of the time is look at the Emmaus story. And as one particular episode, we're talking about, okay, now how are we going to do this as a wilderness kind of thing? And this is a story I think we're very familiar with, the walk to Emmaus. So I'm not going to read it. It is rather long, but I underline some of the key words as, you know, as we go through the story. But in a sense, I mean, the key part here at the very, very beginning, now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And it's interesting, the 7 miles, I have a footnote here, as far as 7 miles. The Greek actually says 60 stadia. And a stadia was a, you see the word stadium in there, about 200 meters or 200 yards. And so a stadium originally was like a 220-yard dash kind of thing. That's when stadiums were built. So a stadia would be then 1/8 of a mile. So the Greek says 60 stadia, and that would be, 56 would be 7 miles. So maybe 7.5 miles, something like that.
My footnote says 160 stadia.
Okay, does it say that, or it says other ancient authorities read 160
yes,
stadia,
yeah.
Which then would be 860, 20 miles. 20-mile walk, 7-mile walk?
In one day,
yeah.
And it's not great terrain either, so.
Yeah. Well, it's a little, yeah. It's not quite as bad as going up the whole lake.
No.
It's not quite steep.
Thank you.
I sat there looking at the 160, though, because, 160 is 4 times 40. And that might be the reason that somebody, I'm putting too much 40 stuff in here. But, I mean, it's a long, still, 7 miles is a long distance, and it really didn't happen until Sunday afternoon, likely, because, they know about the whole story with the women. They know about that. They talk about that on the road. And they get there by supper time. The sun's going down. And then the amazing thing is after making that trek, we can't stay here. We got to go back. And so that evening, they get back to Jerusalem yet too. So they do a lot of hiking that particular day. Okay. Now the movement there I find is kind of interesting is this in a way a back to the wilderness kind of story? The whole story I wrote up here, and I realize it's kind of small, but Luke, the movement of Luke is we start with Jesus in the wilderness and the temptation story at the beginning. Jesus moves to ministry in small towns and villages, and then we move to the city of Jerusalem. And of course, what happens in Acts is it's going to be moving from city to city. And what we found in the story of Jesus is Jesus would frequently retreat from the villages, to find strength and to reflect, and then come back to the villages. And even in Jerusalem, Jesus would retreat from the city to the Mount of Olives. And is this, in a way, we're leaving and going back to the wilderness kind of thing, in a way? And I realize they go back to their home village. And one of the problems with Emmaus, nobody really knew where Emmaus was. I mean, it's a town. This is odd about the story. It's the only time it's ever mentioned in the Bible. And there are guesses today where it is, and it's always pinpointed somehow west of Jerusalem. But if you go 7 miles from Jerusalem in other directions, what do you run into?
Desert, wilderness.
Yeah. I mean, if you go southeast 7 miles, you're out there in real wilderness territory. And in general, that's the area where the temptations ever occur. Yeah, you're moving towards the direction of the Dead Sea. You'll be about halfway to the Dead Sea there. And I was just looking at that and trying to think about that. And, moving away from the city, going back. But that what's significant about them moving away is that it's their time to reflect. And you have this whole discussion taking place. And that's, that's why we go to the wilderness. I mean, a lot of it is to be alone, to pray. I mean, like here at Holden, we come together to look at things and to talk about them and try to get new insights. That's what they're doing, the talking and the discussing, how important that is. And in their midst, of course, is Jesus, that they can't quite recognize him. And that's always the puzzling part of the story. What is it that they don't, how is it that their eyes are kept? Is it the sorrow? Is it, whenever you have a movie, he's always having a hood over his face, that kind of stuff. But when you think about how often, we're struggling with some kind of issue and you're sitting down and having a Bible study and everything, and it's just, you're going through all this, and then all of a sudden at the end, it's kind of realization that, the Lord has been with us all along in this whole wrestling kind of thing. And in this particular case, basically, the presence of Jesus has really, at first, a couple functions. One is to give them a way to then talk about the story again, because he's the stranger And so they have to go back and list out all that has happened. And so they then explain what's been going on for the last few days, and they then give their interpretation. And then the second thing then that Jesus does is starts at, well, have you looked here? Have you looked here? You know, raising those texts in the Old Testament. He's trying to make connections of how to interpret it. And then the final thing, of course, is then, basically after, the next page, put it up here. It's a two-page thing. You can't just leave it there with them giving their comments. Then on the next page, what happens, I think is very significant, is after Jesus talks about, wasn't it necessary? Wasn't it necessary? Now let's look at all this in the Old Testament. Wasn't it necessary the Messiah should suffer? You had hoped such and such, but wasn't it necessary? And so he interprets Moses and the prophets. He digs out of the scriptures there and gives them the insight. But what happens next, I think, is very significant, is that, they do come to the village, but at this point, they are no longer the dejected people, but they are doing exactly what Jesus has been teaching along the way. They open their home to him. And the this is where you get the minnow. Stay with us. They are providing the hospitality. So they have made that step. They have made that step for doing what occurs all along the way from Galilee and the journey to Jerusalem, sharing their possessions. And they have reached that particular point, even though they still don't recognize him, but then it's in the breaking of the bread that then their eyes are opened and they realize it's connected with the opening of the scriptures there, and that drives them to action. It's not just, aha, we have it, let's think some more about it, and maybe we should sit down and write all this out, but it's, aha, we got to do something about it. We got to jump on our feet and run back those 7 miles to Jerusalem. And they get there fairly early, which is amazing. Still, disciples are gathered together. And they have come to the same conclusion as the disciples there in Jerusalem. Okay? So, in a way, that to me, you can read it as kind of a back to the wilderness, kind of a retreat to the wilderness. Now, their intention, was their intention to ever come back? But it's going out and reflecting. And, I wanted to look at it in that kind of way. The other thing, I recently read an article that kind of struck me about this story. And it was a scholarly article about the origins of this particular story by a man by the name of Dennis McDonald. Are you from Denver?
Yeah.
You know the name Dennis McDonald? Is he at Iowa or Denver University? New Testament scholar. And he looks at this story and says there's some kind of interesting parallels with a very old, in a sense, a wilderness story. Now, throughout Luke, there are all allusions to the Old Testament and the wilderness experience of Israel. Luke is as I said before, I believe Luke is a Gentile writer, and he's writing for Gentiles, and he brings in allusions to the scriptures there, but for Gentile audiences, wouldn't it be kind of appropriate to bring in references in the Greek culture to kind of wilderness experiences too? And he finds some very interesting kinds of things in the story and says, let's look back to Homer and the story of Odysseus. Very familiar with the story of Odysseus? Ulysses, Odysseus. Fascinating story. You'll have to help me because I read the article and I don't have it with me as far as all the details. But he actually found some word-for-word parallels in that particular story. But the story of Odysseus, they even just recently made a mini-series on TV, didn't they?
Yeah.
I haven't watched the whole thing, but... Odysseus goes off to war, the Trojan War, right? And then the Trojan War is over. Okay, that's 10 years. And then he heads home, but he has his own wilderness experience on, basically by sea. Instead of going through the desert, he ends up wandering for... Does anybody know how long is it? Is it 40?
40. 10 more years.
Oh, it's only 10. It's not the 40? So 10 and 10.
It must be 40.
Well, we can stretch that.
We're working on it.
Okay, so 20 years. Okay, well, good. But, his wandering is in a way like the wandering of the Israelites, kind of finding his way and finding out what's important to him. But then when he finally gets back home, he gets the promised land. Of course, the big thing is his faithful wife Penelope is there waiting, and you have all these other suitors, you know, that part of the story, and she's been putting him off for all these years, convinced that he's going to return home. And when he returns home, there's something different about him, of course. I mean, 20 years ago. And I'm not sure exactly if some of you have a side. I don't know if he encounters her at first and she doesn't recognize him.
When he's Athena, changes him into a beggar.
That's right. Okay.
And
yeah.
So
and
he's disguised,
even, disguised even more. Which, you know, it's kind of thing about their eyes were kept from recognizing.
But the
yeah.
It's yeah. one of the servants in the household who is
yeah.
talking with him or.
It's the servants, okay?
Taking care of him or something, and he has some yeah. sort of a scar, birthmark,
yeah.
or something
yeah.
from his youth that she recognizes.
She recognizes, yeah.
And so, he has to warn her not to talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He reveals, in a sense, well, he first reveals himself to the servants. And there's actually two servants that he knows from way back. They're the ones that first recognize him. And it takes place not, I don't think, in the palace, but they actually go to a cabin a little bit removed in the woods, I think, is where this takes place. And they're alone, away, away from Jerusalem, where everybody's just, up in arms and what's happening here, and the Roman soldiers, but they're away in the woods, and the two servants are there. And there are several things that bring about the recognition, and one is, of course, the scar. When he was a kid, he had cut himself in the leg or something like that, and the servant had taken care of him, and she's washing his feet or something, the scar. And of course, now, it's not here, but the next part, but Jesus, the real proof are the scars. Not the signs of power, but Jesus' scars, the wounds, are the real proof. See, have that element there in that story, just the scars. But then, they break bread, they have a meal together, and somehow in that meal, it's recapturing that past. And the other element, there's something about when Ulysses was a child, he planted two trees. And so he goes out and he points out, these are the two trees. And I was part of planting those, and now they're grown up. And I was talking about making the wilderness connection, being out in nature and seeing that kind of thing. But then their eyes are opened, and then he goes back to the palace, and then he has the show of strength, and he's able to fix the bow, and nobody else can do it, and then he shoots the bow, and that's the convincing kind of proof, the show of power. But the other things are a kind of the weakness kind of thing, and back to the wilderness kind of thing. And it's interesting reading that from Dennis McDonald and kind of looking at that and wondering, Luke is doing this for audiences from the Greek culture. That kind of story may help them understand it. Now, one of the things that's fascinating from the McDonald thing and looking at that story is that, you remember anything about the names of the servants? You, Sally, you know that story pretty well, better than I do.
But I teach the servant. I don't remember the names of the servants.
I mean, this
one was the nurse, his nurse, former nurse, and the other was a male.
Yeah, I was a gardener kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the name of the one of them, and I should have gone back and looked at that. I read this article while I didn't bring it with me, but one of their names is something like Eurycles?
Euryclea.
It's Eurycles, and that would be the nurse name. That's feminine. Okay, Euryclea. And that's interesting because the Clea part, this is actually comes from two words. Clea, I don't know if I'm writing big enough, is from a Greek word that is kleos, which means fame, reputation. And Eura is a word that means kind of like wide fame, broad fame. So there's something about that word. Now what's interesting in that story is we have one person named here. You have a character named Cleopas, which in Greek is written Cleo. It comes from the same root here. The pas part is all. So broad fame or all fame are the names of these two characters. And is that Luke's way of just kind of saying, okay, think of that story. That was the
That was, I guess that's the nurse, because it's Cleo. The other one, and I don't know how it's spelled, but the interesting about the other name is something like Eumenes or something like that. Anyway, it's somewhat similar to the name Emmaus. So the two names in this story have kind of connections with the two names in the Ulysses story. And when you think about that, so, okay, what's going on here? You know, we frequently do stuff with, you know, going back to the Old Testament and bringing Old Testament allusions into New Testament stories. But, you know, is that okay to do that with other cultures, too? Besides, you know, and if he's writing for Greeks, we need to make those kind of connections. Now, what you can do with that, of course, is, you know, you can go in several directions. Is one, okay, he's totally fabricated this kind of story on the basis of this. And, you know, that's one way you can do it. Or he's kind of put in these kind of connections here as clues. Maybe he knew the name, maybe he didn't, maybe he saw the names, and he thought, you know, that was kind of the point where he thought of the connection here. And so to tell it in such a way that's similar to this other story he had before. But, that's kind of a new, you know, looking at the text in kind of a similar kind of way. And when I kept looking at the Ulysses thing, is this part of it is, you know, they retreated out kind of in the countryside, and that's where they had the meal. And the thing about the two trees is kind of intrigued me, because that's kind of nature kind of thing. And, I mean, in a way, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing about trees here, but I mean, it's almost like, okay, look at our roots. And, you know, so we look at the scriptures as kind of the, you know, that's where our roots are. I don't know if that's too much of a leap or anything here. But the point is that in that story, Ulysses goes to the countryside, and it all comes together. And then that propels him to the palace, to the city. And saying that that's kind of the thing here, too. Retreating to the wilderness and then being propelled back to Jerusalem. And then they wait in Jerusalem for the Holy Spirit, and then that moves them out. So it's certainly a feeding story. I mean, it fits in with the whole theme of Jesus constantly going back to the wilderness and reflecting and looking at your roots and how that then moves people on. But that's, again, I don't know, but that's just basically intriguing and it struck me. I don't know, any reactions or anything anybody sees in this particular story.
I guess I see the wilderness mostly in them and the two men. Or two people.
Can you elaborate just a little bit more on
this? It's just that you talked the other day about the temptations of Jesus, mm-hmm. and Jesus is kind of putting to them some of the information that they should have had and should have. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of, in their minds or in their hearts, they're kind of just out here going, go back to where their friends are who know about what they know and say, you know, this is. So I see the wilderness more in them than in the geographical. So.
Okay, yeah. And I like that.
It seems to me there are a lot of connections, too, with some of those stories leading up to Jesus' death, too, of God. We'll never leave you, and then the weakness of faith of the disciples, so the leaving, and this continuing thing, and I know that connects with, they weren't expecting this kind of leader, this kind of, they were looking for something else than what they got.
The false expectations.
Yeah, and so it kind of follows on, but I mean, we're always taught when you think of the doubter, I mean, the first one is Thomas, but you look at these stories, and there was Peter, and there are these disciples, and there are many doubters, and I think one of the neat things is the women's witness that was so sure, but the men are full of doubt in many times. We don't know who the other disciple was, but Thomas wasn't the one talking with the man. But
why not?
Could
have been. See, that's the other big theory. As far as the names, there is a character named Clopas.
Yeah.
Clopas and the wife of Clopas. Now, it's different from Cleopas, but that's one other theory, is that the wife of Cleopas was at the cross in John's Gospel, and so could have been Mr. and Mrs. Cleopas here. So a male and a female disciple.
But it's so parallel to our lives. Mm. We as God's people, Christ's followers, disciples, ministers in our daily lives, whatever we do, how we go through these times of doubt, and then God comes to us in a way again. I mean, it reminds me of the play last week. If anybody was here for that, it was so right on. A little girl was God, and her line kept saying, "Don't you know I'm here? I've never left you. I'm always here." You know, and it's this story and the other stories surrounding this are so much we can identify with, because even no matter how close or how strong we may be, we go through these same times of dryness and desert times in our own lives and dark nights of the soul and distance from God and all of that, and how we all need the wilderness time or the time of retreat or renewal or to recognize Christ again in our life. Mm-hmm. Who's always been there, but we somehow just don't yet.
Mm-hmm. And Jerusalem is the busy, bustling city, and all these events are bam, bam, bam. All this has happened so fast, and you've got to step back. And that's the natural order, is the stepping back and reflecting. And that's what happens in this particular story. Okay, they did ring the bell. So, tomorrow, of course, is Jubilee Day, and I don't know if you've seen the schedule, but we're going to be looking at Jubilee texts tomorrow in the Bible study. That's the instruction.